Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight in the middle of your black pants party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. It's rainy Thursday night. You're joining me on the other end of the line, Ben, how long did take you to catch back up after that marathon this past weekend?
Man.
Just catch your breath.
It's still about Tuesday night, I guess. We took a while to unpack and everything, but yeah, it was a long weekend. It's good. It's good to see everybody. Good to see you on Friday.
Yeah, you had a busy booth. And
yeah.
It was a really cool. I liked your setup compared to last year. I really, really liked y'all setup.
Thank you. Man, I hate you missed it. Saturday afternoon, the guy who played music Saturday afternoon was incredible. I'm talking about, a showstopper. The boy had, people were standing in the aisles and in our booth, and it was really, really, really fun time Saturday afternoon about 4 o'clock, from 4 to 6, really. He played almost 2 hours. It was fantastic. I mean, he did some Johnny Cash, and he did Lil' Kenny Chesney, and some Garth, and some Waylon, and Willie, and I mean, he was quite the impersonator, and impersonator is probably not the right word for what he does, but I mean, he can sing like these guys and play like these guys, and I mean, just he played all this music for dang near 2 hours without stopping. He wasn't looking at words. I mean, he was just playing, and then he'd play a little Cody Jinks, a little, you know, Chris Stapleton. He did just a little bit of everything. It was incredible. So
you had the perfect place to set somebody up like that, because in your mind, if you're listening to this and you're looking down on it, Spence and Rolling Thunder had a booth to the left. You had a wide aisle in between with a lot of seats for people to sit around in, and then right to the right of those seats was Southern Prairie Outfitters and Jed Lamb, which, you know, it was a great, great setup. I got to ask you this. I mean, what was the feedback like? I mean, because a lot of things have changed for you for the better in the way the public views you. And what kind of feedback did you get from people that were walking around?
Well, I mean, the funny thing, I got a lot more comments about this podcast than I did anything else. And you've kept telling me that would happen, but I didn't really believe you. But I was shocked at how many people said something along the lines of, been listening to your story on the podcast, you know. It's like, really? Part of me's like, people actually listening to things? Man, it was a great show. We brought 3 custom colors of Brutes and sold them, and pretty much before lunch on Saturday, it was from 9 to about 1 on Saturday was just nuts. I mean, nuts. It was standing room, just shoulder to shoulder. Best show we've ever had there. So if you've never been to NWTF, I highly recommend, you know, packing the family up and taking them. Friday is definitely a different feel than Saturday. Saturday's fast paced and kind of excited. Friday's way more laid back and a little bit slower, but it is really a great show. Lots of stuff for your kids to see. Did your kids get to hold the bald eagle and the snake and stuff there at the entrance?
They love the eagle. And the greatest picture that I took at the NWTF was two out of my three went with me and the wife to NWTF. But the greatest picture I took was them petting the snake. And my wife is deathly afraid of snakes, and she's way 30 yards away from the booth with the snakes in it. So that turned out really good.
Good.
Let me ask you this before we leave this topic. Friday.
Okay.
Is that the busiest Friday that you remember in all your years of being there? Because I think it was packed. That's the most people I've seen.
Friday was definitely busy. I did better last year on Friday than I did this year, in terms of total dollars sold kind of thing. But I mean, this was close second. I mean, it's hard to tell. There were definitely a lot of people there on Friday, especially Friday morning. Friday morning was pretty busy. Friday afternoon slowed down a little bit, but of course, you had rain this year on Friday. Last year on Friday, it was sunshiny, it was a pretty day. And whenever you do shows like that or in-store events and promotions, stuff like that, man, rain is like your best friend. I'll never forget one year at Max. Uncle Si was signing teal teacups with a black Sharpie at Wings Over at the August fall sale at Max, and it started raining, and I mean, it was like people came out of the woodworks, and I don't remember how many thousands of teacups Uncle Si signed, but I mean, it was insane. People, the line to see him was like two laps around the store, it's because it's rain, it's like there's people are not doing anything else when it's raining. So that definitely helps this Friday.
Well, I got to tell you, you warned me back in November, December, when it payback came, it was going to be good.
I told you, he has nothing better to do than to get you back. And he proved me right.
And I don't know if you heard it the other day, but my wife happened to have my phone. We swapped services over to AT&T, so she took the brunt of it for me. Her and the AT&T salesman.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still getting calls at like 10:30 at night. Literally, people were calling me for my Toyota truck and my boat that was supposedly for sale at 10:30 at night. Who calls about a classified at 10:30 at night?
Man, every red-blooded male in the southeastern United States wants that 1993 Toyota with a 548 War Eagle on the back of it. I mean, there's the only thing more American than that would be a bald eagle sticker on the back window. I mean, come on.
I never saw the ad. I just knew it was a Toyota for sale. No, I never saw the ad.
The ad is epic. I don't know where Rob came up with all that he wrote and stuff. It's unbelievable. The ad said that you would meet people anywhere in the eastern half of Arkansas.
It's like a gray
93 Toyota with the kind of the lighter gray stripe down the side. I mean, it is when people think about, when Generation Xers think about a Toyota Tacoma, it's what you vision in your mind. I mean, my neighbor had one growing up. I thought it was the greatest truck of all time. I mean, they put them in Happy Meals and stuff. I mean, that with a clean War Eagle and a 40 horse Nissan on the back of it. I mean, good gracious, for $7,000, that is a deal and a half. You can be a legit Arkansas public land duck hunter, for $7,000 right there out the door, bam.
My phone, like I said, text messages and phone calls just absolutely blew up. But we'll see what comes. I know you've warned me about firing another shot over the bow of his boat, but I love pulling pranks. Oh, man. I may have messed with the king.
Rocky, I probably shouldn't say this, but I know what the follow-up prank is going to be if you get him. If you come back for seconds, he's already got the next one planned. And all I can tell you is you really don't want to go there. I mean, you really don't want to go there. But if you do, I just, fair warning. I called it the first time around. I'm calling it now. He's going to inflict some serious pain. Ever heard about the – speaking of pranks, I'm going to tell this story real quick and then we can get back on topic. Have you ever heard the story about the prank that I pulled on Ronnie Turner?
No.
So a couple years
I'm all for a good prank story too.
Well, I'll try to give you the short version, but you should probably interview Ronnie Turner sometime and just ask him about it. You can ask Rob about it on Mondays with Rob, and he'll tell you it's the single greatest internet prank of all time. But basically, I created a fake profile, and I started posting on all these call pages looking for Ronnie Turner duck calls. And every time that I would post on there looking for a Ronnie Turner duck call, I would make some little kind of half-hearted, insinuated, of a sexual nature, but very, very vague. And it got to freaking Ronnie Turner out so bad. And I came up with some pictures, and I downloaded one of those apps where you could put makeup on, it's like the little girls have these apps where you take a picture and then you can put makeup on the picture. And so I started going through Ronnie's pictures and putting makeup on them and posting them with the duck call pictures. Well, Ronnie got so worked up about it. I mean, he was legit about to call the police. He was fearful that he started messaging people, lots of his friends, lots of his call maker friends. I mean, made it incredibly public. And it culminated with me making a video, talking to the camera, introducing myself as the fake profile. And most of the part, he was so embarrassed because, like, he legit, Rocky, had 20 or 30 different people, call makers all across the country, trying to figure out who this guy was that was, like, his stalker collector guy. And, I mean, it really, really messed with his head. But he bought into it so hard that he was just asking people, to help him figure it out. So when I made it real public that it was a prank, he couldn't undo it because he had already freaked out to all these different people. And I mean, to this day, me and Ronnie are like we're acquaintances and friends, kind of. But like, deep down, he holds it against me. I mean, 3-4 years later, we're talking about it's hard for him.
Really?
Just ask Rob on Monday about it.
He makes a beautiful call. Jeez.
Yep.
All right, well, a couple of weeks ago when we left the story, you'd gotten into a couple of stores.
Yeah.
With the help. And what's so crazy about it? Somebody last week, this topic came up about getting calls in a store. And I said, you've got to pull a Spence. He said, what is that? I said, you got to get one of your buddies to call and ask for the calls.
Yeah, I don't know if that would even work anymore, but it sure worked then. I guess that first fall we were in Max and D&W in Jonesboro and Hawks. Those are kind of the three stores that we were in, and they sold good in Max and in D&W, and they sold pretty good at Hawks. The barrels never caught on, but I took all the barrels back from Max a year later. But when we started, I had it in my head that selling, I don't know why I decided this, but I just convinced myself that people would want to buy a barrel for their ult that was virtually indestructible, that they'd want to put their ult barrel away and then use this barrel instead. And so I sold all these retailers. I mean, I literally sold them a plastic duck call barrel, no insert, no nothing. It was just a barrel. I don't know if any of them sold even one single one of them. I told them that I would take them back, and sure enough, they didn't sell them. So I took them back and put inserts in them and sold them to them as duck calls. The next challenge, once I sold some of them, the next challenge was we had to come up with a way to do packaging. And we didn't have a clue. I didn't know the first thing about duck calls, how they were packed. I mean, I didn't know the first thing about how duck calls were packaged or how they were sold in stores or what you did. And so I tried to look at what the old packaging looked like. It kind of looked like a Rapala crankbait. You know, it's like a cardboard box with a clear plastic lid. And I priced those out, and that didn't really work. And it was going to be an outrageous amount of money. And so then I was trying to be different. You know, I was trying really hard to be different than kind of what everybody sees on the shelf, and kind of being trying to look vintage like the old Olds was different enough, but because nobody was doing that, but that packaging was so expensive that then we had to kind of figure out what could we do other than clamshells. That was kind of what everybody had on the shelf, was a clamshell. And so what we came up with was we bought these clear plastic tubes. They were in 4 foot lengths, and they were about as big around as, say, a golf ball, you know, like an inch and a half or 2 inches in diameter. And we cut them in 4 inch or 5 inch lengths. And the same company that you could buy these tubes from, you could buy plugs for the top and plugs for the bottom. And so we'd buy these tubes, and then I'd cut them on like a radial arm saw or a table saw in the same length. Just chop them, boom, 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 and then you had, from there, you had to glue the plug in the bottom, which was just a clear plug that was flat on the bottom, and you put a little ring of glue and you slid it up in there, and then you had a bottom, and then the plug was like a black plastic cap that had a hole in it. And so we'd build these tubes, and then you put the cap on it, and so now all you have is like, you have a clear cylinder that's about 2 inches in diameter, and it's about 5 inches tall with a little black cap on it. And then we had to figure out, you know, that you can't just drop a duck call in there and then hang it on the shelf. Like, you gotta identify what it is, and, you know, you gotta put the logo on it and stuff like that. But the problem with all of this is you gotta realize this is like end of September when we sold the first ones to Max. And they wanted them like immediately. You know, they were ready to put them on the shelf. They bought them. And so we're scrambling around trying to figure out how in the world we're going to do packaging. Bought these tubes. We started cutting them into lengths and gluing them together. And we ended up coming up with the idea that we could make a piece of paper that was basically like we could take a flat piece of paper and cut it out and then glue it together, so that the piece of paper made a liner for the inside of the cylinder. And then you'd slide that down in the tube and then drop the call down in there. And so that when you glued the paper together, you had a window through the paper where you could see you could actually see the call through the window that you'd cut. And then on the backside, you had a place you could put a barcode or a place you could put a description or something about, you know, the call. And so almost for the first year, that's how we made our packaging. And we printed it out on a inkjet printer at the house, and me and Lindy would sit in the living room, and she would cut those things out with scissors, and we bought these little things that looked like glue dots, and we put the little tab on the piece of paper, we'd you know, stick it with the glue and glue it in a circle and drop it down in that tube and then put a call in there. And so by the time we built the packaging and then dropped the call in there, I mean, there's no telling how much time we had in each one of those duct
calls. That's what I was going to say.
Because that's just the packaging. To get the duct call, the mold that we had was so sloppy that when it came out of the mold, it had a big flat piece of plastic on the mouthpiece, and on the non mouthpiece side of the barrel, both ends of the barrel. See, the mold is two pieces. Okay, it's like a left side and a right side. When it comes together and you shoot the material in there, it makes the call. But if the two sides of the mold don't fit together perfect, and then you have like a little bit of material that slips out in between the imperfection of where they line up, and that happened on every call. And so when the call came out of the mold, the kid that was the grad assistant at the time, the duck call man, that kid, he would stand there with a razor knife and he would cut this lip off of it. It was a big flat piece of plastic right on the mouthpiece. He would cut it off, but it would make the mouthpiece just almost, you couldn't use it because it was just this sharp, rough spot. But he cut it off because we would grind down those little pieces of plastic and we'd, you know, rerun them through the mold. So when you got a box of parts, which they would leave in a grocery sack or in a box, you know, at the back door CBU, so we'd slide in there after work and get a box of parts, and you'd get a box of these barrels, and I mean, they were rough, real rough. And from there, we had to take them back to the house to a lathe, and you had to sand them down. You had to sand the mouthpiece. You had to spin them in a lathe and sand the mouthpiece down just so you could blow on it. And so for the first little while, like, the process was we'd mold a barrel. The guy that got them out of the mold would cut the slag off the mouthpiece and then put them in a box. You pick up the box would have a whole bunch of parts in it. And then before you could do anything with those parts, you had to take off what we call the gate. And the gate was like an L-shaped piece of plastic where the molten polycarb would go in through a tube, turn a corner, and then shoot into the cavity of the mold. Well, when the mold opened, you had not only the call, but you had like the little piece where where the plastic had gone in. So you had to tear that part off and then cut it smooth with a razor knife. And then you had to trim up the edges on the backside, like where the insert would go in. Well, once you had it all rough trimmed, then you had to take it to the lathe, spin it in the lathe. But the rough spot on the mouthpiece was so rough that you had to start with about 80 grit sandpaper, because you got to remember, this material is incredibly hard. We custom blended this material to be, I mean, it's dang near bulletproof. You could drive over with a pickup truck and it didn't crush it. And so you couldn't just like, you couldn't buff it out. You couldn't sand this out with like 220. So when you put it in the lathe, you had to first sand it down with like 80 grit sandpaper, and you had to, you know, slick it up with the 80 grit and be rough, but you're just slicking it down to where you got something to work with. And then you go to like a 220, and then you go to a 400 or something like that sandpaper. So every barrel had been sanded with three levels of sandpaper by somebody standing over a lathe, and it would take, you know, 3 to 10 minutes per barrel. And I'll never forget the first kind of advancement that we made in that was Wes and I decided that we just didn't have time to sand those barrels at night. We were selling too many of them and too many people wanted them. And so we called a friend of ours that had lived in Spain for 5 years working for his company, and he knew Spanish fluently. And when he came back to America, he kind of had a heart for Spanish Americans, people that were working in America and spoke Spanish. And so he started a ministry to Hispanic people, primarily teaching them English as a second language. And so he had all these Hispanic laborers that he was teaching how to speak English. I mean, and they were, you know, it was 150, 200 Mexican folks and Cuban and all these other, you know, like Latin American folks, I guess. They were all from different countries down there, not just Mexico. But and he found us a guy whose name literally was Jose. And so we had a guy named Jose, and Jose did not speak a lick of English. Jose could not say my name. He worked for us for a year, and I don't think I ever heard Jose say Rolling Thunder, Spence, you know, America. He just nodded, and so for a long period of time, I don't know how long, but for a long period of time, I would go pick up a box of parts from CBU, take them over to Wes's house, because Wes had one of those little modular barn things like you get off the parking lot at Home Depot, you know, and right. He had electricity run out to it, and we had a lathe in there. The lathe was actually borrowed. It was from our friend Brad. He had given us this lathe to use, and we had a guy named Jose with a extension cord and one of those, you know, shop lights that was hanging from the extension cord from the ceiling, that thing. And Jose would stand out there all day, and he would sand those barrels down. And in a good day, a really good day, Jose could do about 35 or 40 of them in a day. And then at the end of the day, I would go back by Wes's house, and I would pick up all the parts that Jose had done that day. And then at night, I would have a bunch of inserts tuned up to go in those barrels. And then at night, I would fit the inserts to go into those barrels. And it was just like the fact that we had someone who could make those barrels comfortable enough that you could put them on your mouth and it wasn't me was like the first giant step. We thought we were kings. You know, we thought we got ourselves an employee. We got somebody to sand these mouthpieces down. Never. I mean, you got an engineer and whatever I am, an entrepreneur, never occurred to us that we needed to make a mold that fit together better. You know, so that we didn't have to go through all these steps. And then meanwhile, you know, Miss Lindy's up there cutting out packaging with scissors. It looked like craft time, you know, in a kindergarten class. She'd have little pieces of paper everywhere. But literally, I remember finishing the first Max order, and all 12, we sold them in dozens. All 12 duck calls were in these little tubes. And I mean, I'd cut the tube, glued it, put a little piece of tape over the cap so that it wouldn't fall off, you know, when you put it on the peg. Lindy had cut out the packaging. We had printed it on our laser jet printer. She had cut it out, glued it together, like with Elmer's glue, slid it down in this tube, and then I'd put a duck call down in there. And you know, we had 12 of them. And we were retailing them. At the time, I believe that I was telling Max they needed to sell them for $40, and my price to them was like $22.50 or $21.50 or something like that. And I'll never forget. We put all those things in the box. It was like 12 times $21, you know. And I was thinking, man, I just did a lot of work for $300. You know,
man, you're not kidding.
But we did it, and we sold them, and we did the same thing, you know, for the D&W and for the Hawks order. But the next thing that happened,
what's the call cost now?
$50.
Still, I mean, you just perfected the process. You made it's a lot cleaner now. I know. Of course it is.
Yeah, it's a lot cleaner. It's a lot cleaner. And we're probably, now we don't actually do injection molding anymore. Right this moment, we do what a lot of folks call cold molding or pour molding with a resin. It's a latex-based resin. It's not nearly as rigid. It's dense, but it's not nearly as rigid. It's not nearly as abrasive, abrasion resistant. Like, you can't, if you you drove over an original cut right now, it would just squish it flatter than a damn pancake. I mean, it would just it turn it to dust. But we did that because we got that method of molding is a lot more accurate, and so we gave up some durability that you don't really need in the first place for just tremendous consistency. The amount of sanding that I had to do on the tone board, every one of those first calls, it was enough that like I could tune about four calls and then my right hand hurt, because you had to bear down on those inserts so hard on the sandpaper to get it to change shape. I mean, we might as well have been making those things out of concrete blocks. I mean, you don't, until you've tried to sand and change the shape of one of those tone boards, you can't even begin to appreciate how hard the plastic we were making these things was. It was bulletproof. I mean, I'm telling you, I believe you could have shot it with a 270 from 100 yards and it would have just, you know, it would have dinged up the lead on 270 bullet. This stuff was incredibly hard. It was overkill, you know, but we didn't know. We were just trying to make a better mousetrap. Yeah.
Do you and Lindy look back at this and laugh about it now?
Right this moment, no, we don't laugh about much of it because we got a 13-year-old and a 12-year-old right now, and they both get their period at the same time. You know, and we got a 7-year-old that is trying to keep from killing neighborhood cats and dogs and, you know, raccoons. And I mean, so no, we hadn't laughed about it much. We kind of got our hands full with.
No. I'm just talking about as far as the process being it's smooth now.
Honestly, Rocky, we hadn't talked about it a single time since then. But that's just the woman that I'm married to, man. She's just a champ. I mean, she'd sit down and watch TV and cut those things out and never complained once, glad to help. And then one day, you know, I got a little bit better packaging and I realized you had to put it in a clamshell. And I mean, I bought a box of clamshells. Hell, you had to buy them by like, you know, a box of like 580 clamshells. And I remember telling Lindy, there ain't no way we'll sell 580 duck calls, you know, and then reorder another box of those things. And, you know, when I needed her to cut them out, she was glad to cut them out. But then all of a sudden one day when I had better packaging, we've literally never talked about it since. I mean, it's just who she is. She's never asked for the credit or the glory or anything, but I mean, that's a woman she's folded more t-shirts and put them in more plastic bags and organized more, you know, stuff for trade shows and things than you could ever possibly imagine. I mean, just, she's a champ. Good.
No, I'm just going to say this. I almost feel sorry for some, and I'm not going to, men, buddies, acquaintances that don't have that experience with their wives. I almost feel bad for them because my wife, man, she'll go work at a vet office all day long, jump in here and help me pack bags, do whatever needs to be done with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I take that for granted. I'll admit it, I do. But man, great. It's great to have a wife that they just jump right in. They may be half dead, but it's great to have a wife that'll just fall right in there and help you.
Yeah, and you got to remember, we were doing this stuff together. Both of us were really sick at this time. I mean, I wasn't cough sick, but I mean, I did most of this stuff with a bandage on my eye. I mean, I had no vision, and I was constantly getting treatment for my eye at this time. And she was just barely coming out of this funky Crohn's disease talk. They thought she had some kind of a Crohn's disease, and she was just getting better from it. So, I mean, not only was she willing to help and pitch in where she was needed, you know, it wasn't like we were living on Easy Street. We were living upstairs in my parents' house, and we didn't have a living room. We had a television, and it was literally in a little sitting room off the side of the hallway in my parents' house upstairs. I mean, it wasn't like we put the kids to bed and we went and sat in the living room and enjoyed one another's company. I mean, our kids were sleeping on a bunk bed in a closet. That's not a lie. It's still a bunk bed in that closet. it's a closet that just happened to be in a spot in my parents' house where it's big enough to put two kid bunk beds. And so Lindy and I slept in the hall bedroom upstairs, and the kids slept in that closet. And we were, and it was a nice house. Don't get me wrong. It's not like we were living in a little bitty shack or nothing, but the house was not set up for two families to live in. And we were making the best of it. And, you know, she just went right along with it. And never,
you know, Spencer, I mean, that question has come up this week a lot. I talked to Ramsey about it last night. I talked to Bill Cooksey about it the other day, and I don't want to get into it again. You know, I think everything needs to be said about that topic. How do you make a living? How do you hunt and make a living? Did you just hear what Spence just said? And I appreciate the transparency in Spence telling the story. Man, it's a lot of sacrifice. And still to this day, Spence, you know, your single living does not come from Rolling Thunder.
Right. That's true. It's absolutely true. And it could have a couple times. There have been a couple times where I could have gone all in. But, you know, we made a choice as a family that it was better for us to not – I mean, going full-time in the call business is a risky endeavor. Really risky. And it never felt right for us. And so it was better for us to earn a living another way and then make calls and stuff like that at night so that we could potentially build something one day that it wouldn't be as risky for us to step out of our own living into something else. And I think that's look, I'm not an entrepreneur expert by any stretch of the imagination, but one of the mistakes that I see people make a lot is you hear the advice like follow your heart, do whatever your passion is. I mean, do what, you know, I mean, that's all good and well, but you know, I mean, that only take you so far. Like at some point you got to work, you got to do some work, and work is fun if you do something that you enjoy. But at the end of the day, when Eve ate the apple off of the tree and gave some of it to Adam, we were cursed. And God said in Genesis that, you know, as long as you live on this earth, your work will be toil. And that means that you might enjoy it, but it's work. And there's aspects of work that's just not fun. And you just have to do it. And so what I'm trying to say is one of the mistakes I see people make in entrepreneurship, like when they try to develop a business, try to start something out, they convince themselves that, like, well, what I got to do is I got to just jump in. I got to just take the plunge. And so they do something stupid like quit their job with no way to make a living and replace that. And it's like, you know, just jumping in the ocean in 4,000 foot of water, 200 miles off the shore. Like, yeah, you can swim for a little while, but, I mean, you really think you can swim 200 miles back to the shore? And I'm not saying that we got it all figured out, but one of the things that we did from day one was we just didn't give up our regular job and we worked two jobs. You know, we worked our call business at night and on the weekends and tried to grow it while we still had an income. And, you know, the funny thing happens when you do it that way, you're not as desperate for grocery money. You know, I mean, you got a little, you have some money you can invest back in the business. And when you're under a lot of pressure to make it work so that you can put food on the table for three kids and a wife, you know, it changes the way you think about things like, can I invest in new machinery or could I invest in new equipment or could I invest in a new truck or a new display stand or a new whatever it is, you know, stuff that costs real money, or could I go over there? Could I do this? Could I do that? You know, that kind of stuff takes money. And when you when the money that you make in your business has to go literally to put food on your table, it makes it hard to, you end up looking at that money and going, okay, am I going to feed my kids tomorrow or am I going to invest back in my business? And I don't want to do that. I wanted to be able to invest back in my business until my business could take care of us and still be able to put food on the table and not have to make those value decisions. Because when you put it to that kind of a value, all you're doing is setting yourself up to have conflict with your spouse. And And I didn't want that. There's enough conflict with your spouse over what days you're going to go hunting and where you're going to go hunting and all that, you know. And so I'm rambling and preaching, but
No, you're not.
I mean, when you know, sometimes you just have to take the plunge. But sometimes people say, you know, I'm gonna quit my job and take the plunge, and it's just kind of an excuse for laziness. You know, it's an excuse because you don't want to work two jobs, and working two jobs never hurt anybody. You know, it never killed anybody. Anyways, I'll stop. I'll say one more thing. I can rattle off, and you probably can too, 10 or 12 more entrepreneurs that did it that exact same way. Guys in Duck South, you know, go ask Josh Criswell, you know, what he does on his lunch break. Go ask Ramsey what he did for years, you know, at the same time he was booking hunts, or any other number of people. You know, there's a lot of really good folks that have developed businesses. Go ask Butch Sal what he does when he's exactly – Will Primos, Buck Gardner, you know, I mean, selling telephones to Walmart and duck calls at the same time. And, you know, Butch Reichenbach, you know, he was mayor of Stuttgart there for various periods of time while he was also making duck calls. I mean, it's Rick Dunn. Rick Dunn was a plumbing supply salesman, sold copper pipe and stuff to plumbing stores, you know, and making duck calls at the same time. A lot of people, you know, do that.
Will had him a little shop set up in the back of his restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
But, all right, so you said that there was, well, let me say this. We may have to get to that second challenge next week. We're about to run out of time. Hey, I got to tell you this about somebody I ran into at the NWTF last weekend. We have a shared friend. He's a new friend to you, but his brother is one of my oldest friends from college.
Really? And, who's that?
Let me tell you this. So he said he'd been listening to the podcast with you. I said, really? I said, have you known him for a while? He said, no. We just happened to meet this duck season. I said, oh, okay. How'd y'all meet? He said, we hunted together. I said, really? You got to hunt with Spence? I said, that's got to be pretty cool. He said, yeah. Brooks and Harrison invited me to come up and hunt their place. And they said, look, just drive up to Memphis and meet this guy at this certain location, certain address, hop in the truck and ride with him. He's coming. And Tyler said, sure, that'll be fine.
Are you talking about Tyler Pittman?
Yeah. He pulls up and he looks, he opens the truck door and sees you. Venture, I'm going with you. That was awesome. But his brother Tom and I were fraternity brothers at Mississippi State. Tom is an awesome guy. That's the first time I ever met Tyler. I met him at the NWTF, but I thought that was a great story.
Yeah, that's the first time I met Tyler too, and he seems like a great guy. We have a mutual friend that is a whole nother story for another day, but there was a guy named Casey Montgomery that Rob was pretty close with, and you'll hear Rob tell stories about turkey hunting with Casey. Casey really got Rob hooked on turkeys, and Casey 2 years ago, November of 2016, Casey sat up in bed and coughed twice and died of a heart attack at age 30 or 32. I believe he was 30 or 31, I believe. He had two children, young children, and they were in the bed with him at the time. And, man, it hit us like a ton of bricks. Casey was like the number one Rolling Thunder fan going. And he had told everybody in his little town that he was a professional hunter with Rolling Thunder game calls. And me and Casey never hunted together once, not even one time. And, but Casey, man, he had the hat and he had the shirt and the stickers, and we talked every day just about. But Casey and Tyler were either first cousins or neighbors or something like that, but they grew up in the same little town there in Chihuahua, in southern, right on the Tennessee-Mississippi border, just north of Corinth. And
wow.
And so yeah, when Tyler climbed in the truck, we, you know, that was kind of like right out of the gate. He said, well, I guess, you know, Casey'd be proud. And I was like, do what? And he was like, you know, I grew up with Casey. And I was like, no way. It's just kind of crazy how small those worlds are, you know?
Yeah. I think it's about just the past. I know the past two turkey seasons, Rob has made a post about Casey.
Yeah. You'll see it. Casey was a special guy, man. He was not perfect. He had a hard life in a lot of ways, but, one of the most sobering things to me about just, I don't know exactly how to say this, but one of the most sobering things about just like being a part of the industry, I guess, or I don't know, whatever it is that makes somebody be your fan, you know, whatever that is. I went to Casey's funeral and they buried him in his Rolling Thunder hat. And
wow,
it said Rolling Thunder 5 times in his obituary. And I'm just telling you right now, I sat there and I looked at Rob and we had a couple other, Casey was an old coon hunter and I had several mutual friends with Casey that I had coon hunted with and whatnot. I mean, I told them all. I was like, guys, I got no category for this. I mean, I had never hunted with Casey. I gave him some calls, and we talked about it. We were gonna hunt. In fact, Casey was supposed to go to Canada with me and Rob and Derek Carota and Josh Criswell and a whole pile of us 2 weeks before he died, and we were so mad at Casey that we couldn't see straight. We were so mad at Casey because he up and, you know, just no showed us literally the day we were leaving. He just didn't show up and didn't answer phone. And I mean, kind of that sort of thing. And looking back, you know, I mean, in the good Lord's providence, the last 2 weeks of Casey's life, he was home and with his kids and not working. And, kind of one of those big picture life things. It was like, holy cow, you know, I mean, somebody thought enough. This is going to sound arrogant, but somebody thought enough of like what we're doing with the brand that his mama and daddy decided to, you know, put that hat on his head in his casket. I mean, geez Louise, you know, that's real life stuff, you know, so Casey's kind of always been I've told Lindy several times, you know, Casey's one of those people that just like a long, hard look at how short life really is and what are you doing with your life, you know, and how are you going to be remembered and what are people going to say about you and, you know, all those kind of things, you know, so that's my connection to Tyler Pittman is Casey.
that's pretty neat. That's a great story. I mean, that 2 years, so it'll be 3 years, I guess it was 2 years this past November. Has he passed?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I believe it was November the 3rd. I believe Casey died November the 3rd, 2016. I have to look that back up. But I believe that's right.
I mean, that, anyway, that's really cool. It's a really neat story. Tyler's a great guy, though. Like I said, I've known his brother Tom for a long, long time. And anyway, I happened to be over there talking to Troy, and they came walking up, and just good to see him because I hadn't seen Tom since college. And he introduced me to Tyler, and Tyler told me that story. I said, man, what a lucky draw. You know, get invited to Harrison and Brooks, and you get to ride with Spence up there.
Well, I don't know. Yep, November the 3rd, I just looked it up. November the 3rd, 2016 is when Casey died.
You know, I asked Tyler, I said, Tyler, what's it like? What's it really like, you know, with Brooks and Spence and Harrison and Murr, Big Murr, all in the same mold? And he said, it's an experience. He said, it really is. It's something to see, something to experience.
It was all pretty new then. That was only about the seventh or eighth time that they'd hunted the island. But we had a good hunt. We had a really good hunt that morning.
All right. Well, look, next week we're going to pick up because you had a second challenge arise that we were about to get into.
Yeah, so sure.
We will save that one for next week. Spence, thank you for taking time out at 9 o'clock at night to record this because I know you're tired, and especially with the weekend, this past weekend you had. Back at it at the clinic. But I appreciate you taking the time to be here. I want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.